Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 145, Neti Neti, Atheism, Vedanta, and Buddha.
It's a little intimidating, the non-duality, according to Nagarjuna, and therefore it's not for everyone. In other words, first you, it builds up in a sort of, higher and higher ability to understand it. But the reason that it's not for everyone, because shunyata is not for everyone. Because shunyata, Nagarjuna has a famous phrase where he says, a misconceived shunyata is it very dangerous, like a mantric spell that is misused, or a snake that is held in the wrong way. And it will destroy you. But what he means by, and therefore you should not teach about shunyata to people who are not prepared for it. But what that means, I think, the way I teach about it to everybody, myself personally, I break Nagarjuna's stricture. And in this modern time. And the reason I do is I have my excuse, which you can refute me, we can debate it. But my excuse for that is, but in Nagarjuna's day in India, most people had some sort of faith in something. You had Hindus and Buddhists and Jains and etc. And they all did believe in something. They were sort of, they were not nihilistic. Only the Charvaka or Lokayata, philosopher was a nihilist, believed that ultimately nothing is the nature of things. And when you die, you have no migration. You have no soul, so you don't migrate. So you simply cease to exist. And that's the danger of a misunderstanding of shunyata, of emptiness, is that misunderstanding it to mean nothingness, and therefore losing all spiritual motivation, all ethical motivation, and therefore being endangered of committing unethical behaviors, and not developing, using your human opportunity of your human intelligence to develop, positive qualities in yourself, thinking that it doesn't matter because ultimately it will all be nothing. So that was considered to be like a very dangerous thing. But in modern time, everybody thinks that they're nothing. That's the consensus reality. Even people who think they believe in something, they live as if all they are is here in this life, and all they're going to get out of it is here in this life, because the consensus reality, the supposed scientists who supposedly know what reality is and tell you what it is in classrooms, in school, not in church, but in school, they assure you that it's been long found out that after death there's no further existence. You become nothing. And then all that stuff about reincarnation or rebirth or soul going to heaven or hell or something like that, that's all some old-fashioned religious superstition which people are terrorized by religious establishments. The law of conservation of energy of thermodynamics teaches that energy is never destroyed. It only changes form. So when with matter goes, everyone acknowledges that there's no instance of anything becoming, not any material or energetic thing becoming nothing. But why then is your consciousness able to become nothing? Is my question. Or is it nothing right now? Then that would be okay if that was the case. But otherwise, how can anything, what evidence is there? My contention being, of course, that the belief that there will be no continuation of consciousness upon the cessation of the brain and the heart and the blood running to the brain, that belief has to be a blind faith dogmatic belief, because there will be no evidence for it. So back to Nagarjuna. in the beginning of his famous book called Wisdom, Prajna, Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the verses that are the root of the central way. He begins with this: I praise that perfect Buddha, the supreme philosopher, who taught us relativity, free of destruction and creation, without cessation and permanence, with no coming and no going, meaning neither unity nor plurality, the quieting of fabrications, bliss supreme. And actually, I confess, I am translating the word Shiva as bliss. Shivam, the last word of his verse is Shivam. Paramam Shivam, highest bliss. But since he didn't believe, Nagarjuna did not disbelieve in Shiva. That actually, that's a wrong thing. Buddhists are not atheists. I think you may know that. No Buddhist was ever an atheist. But they just don't believe that Brahma or Shiva or Vishnu has created everything. They don't blame any one of the gods as being omnipotent, and they don't consider the concept of an omnipotent creator to be a rational concept. So therefore, they don't believe that. But they believe there are beings who are much stronger than human beings and who are divine. It will be defined by us as divine and deva, you know, in Sanskrit. And Buddhists believe that. They talk to them. There are many sutras where Buddha is talking to the gods in great detail, in Pali also, not just Mahayana, in Pali. In fact, there's one wonderful one that I like, where Buddha goes in one summer vacation during the rainy season to teach his mother, who is living in the Trayastrimsha heaven, the 33 heaven, which is the heaven of Indra. And she went there after she passed away, which she did when he was a baby. And he promised that when he became enlightened, he would go teach her. But the poor mom, he teaches her the most boring thing in all of Buddhism, namely the Abhidharma. Now, when he's going to do that, there's one sutra where Indra is chasing around the gods of the 33. And because they are saying, well, he's teaching his mom. Let him teach his mom. We are having a party. We don't want to come to the class. So Indra says, you better come to that class. If you do, because Brahma is coming down from a higher heaven, Akanishta, and Brahma is going to see to it that you 33 deity gods come to class and listen to what Buddha has to say. And if you don't come, he's going to punish you. So he comes down in the form of Panchashika. They say five crested hairdo. You know, Brahma comes down to that heaven, which is in the desire realm. You know, Akanishta is in the realm of pure form, according to the cosmology. So I just want to make that point in case people think Buddhists are Nastikas, meaning they don't believe in the gods. They do. They just don't believe there's any one big boss god, that's all. Or goddess. You know. So the word Shiva here, he means something really good. The word Shiva, even for Buddhists, means a good thing. But he doesn't mean the person in this case. But there are other works of Nagarjuna where he might mention Shiva as a divine person. On the other hand, the Buddhists think that the gods tend to pride. They tend to be a little bit proud. They become a little bit inflated with their divine power and beauty and longevity. And they therefore are less fortunate than humans as far as becoming enlightened, because they've sort of overshot the ideal life form which for becoming enlightened, which is a human, where the human has an intelligence similar to that of the divinities, but the human is very vulnerable and has a short life and is afraid of suffering and very aware of it, immediacy of suffering to the human. So they have a real motive to try to understand the real nature of something and to really realize tattvam asi, to put it in Vedantic terms, you know, that are that, you know, Satchit Ananda, or let's say Satchit Ananda, which I think they all agree, everybody agrees, that's what Nirvana is Satchit Ananda. I don't know about Chit, maybe, depending on what you think of as Chit. The Yogacara Buddhists would agree with Satchit Ananda, but the Madhyamakas might complicate things. So then he begins his first verse. No things are ever found by any means to be produced from themselves, from other things, from both or without causes. So right away it's neti neti with Nagarjuna. And then Chandrakirti, his great commentator from the 6th, 7th century, says that Nagarjuna begins with this sort of very challenging statement of anutpada, of non-production. The reason he does is that when you are meditating and attaining the realization of the prajna paramita, which means transcendent wisdom, if prajna really means wisdom, wisdom may mean in English, to many of us, it may connote a kind of resignation of an elder person who feels that, life is tough and they sort of resign themselves to coping with it, and sort of an acceptance of the way things are being not so great. And that's sort of wisdom. That might be the connotation we have of wisdom, as a kind of resignation to something. An acceptance of some unpleasant thing even, let's say. But prajna doesn't mean that. Nya is, of course, I think the Bengalis would say nya, not gnya. It means to know, right? Like the same in the Greek, gnosis, gnya, same. And pra means super. So it means to super know. And that means to know really deeply with a kind of genius level intelligence. So its symbol in Buddhism is not an old person who's sort of wise and beaten down by the years and accepting of the difficulties. Symbol is a 16-year-old young person called Manjushri, who has a sword of discriminating, analytic, critical wisdom, and a book of the Prajna Paramita in the other hand, and sort of breaking through old, conventional knowledge and something like that, and coming up with a deep insight and understanding of what is reality, what is the nature of reality. I think that's what prajna means, as far as Buddhists go, right? So anyway, when you reach prajna paramita, the transcendent wisdom, what happens is you study 10 samatas, they call it, 10 samenesses or 10 equalities, how you understanding all things are equal. And those equalities, the first of those 10 equalities are the equality of all things in that all things are unproduced, which is kind of a shocking thing to say, because here we feel we're kind of produced. We do, don't we? We all feel that we're produced. However, according to him, and according to Buddhist science in general, if we analyze ourselves with a real reality-seeking, ultimate reality-seeking prajna, wisdom, we will eventually not find anything. Earlier in our conversation, Swamiji mentioned the Upanishadic process known as neti neti, naiti naiti, where to find the Supreme Self, as they call it in Vedanta, you reject all small kinds of self. So in other words, you look through your personality, you look through all sorts of things, and each one of them dissolves under analysis, and you say, well, that isn't the real thing. And then you come up with what you don't come up in a way with anything, but when you reach a kind of place beyond all of these things that you normally identify with as yourself or your identity, then that is called the Supreme Self. But you reach there by a process of negation. So that's really quite similar to what prajna does, where it says things are unproduced. And why did they pick a start, unproduction? Because when we want to understand something, we take it apart, and especially we are concerned with how it's caused. What is its process of causation, right? You want to understand a sickness. Well, how did someone get sick? Did they eat such a thing? Did they have a germ? Did they have a virus? Did they have a cancer? Did they have a whatever it is? Is their immune system compromised? So the way of understanding something that human beings do when they're using their intelligence about these things is by analyzing the causation process of how it came to be caused. And then when you do that in a really deep analytical manner, you will not find ultimately any cause. It will disappear. The causation process will become like expand infinitely, and it will disappear under analysis. And so you will realize that in an ultimately real sense, in a relatively real sense, here we are. But in an ultimately real sense, when you look for it, you cannot find it as having been caused. And so that's what that's called, the realization of non-production or birthlessness, actually, they will sometimes say. Anutpada, usually they say anutpada. So and that's a very deep thing to do. And when you do that, you correct our misperception of things, of relative things, as if they were absolutely real. Do you know what I mean by saying that? And I think, you know, when in that the Upanishad where they go na iti, na iti, na iti, or as people say, neti, neti. But na is it na iti. Iti is just quote. Na means no. So it's negation, right? And then they say neti, neti, you know. And when they do that, they are basically rejecting things that they thought were really real. I think, isn't that a dialogue between Indra and someone? And he's asking Indra, isn't it? The one, Yajnavalkya or somebody is asking Indra, what is yourself? And Indra says, well, I am this and I am that. And he's talking with him. And then he keeps saying, neti, naiti, naiti. Everything that you think you are, you're not. Right? And then finally, well, the Supreme Self is something that comes out as a conclusion of that negational process. So anyway, Indra was unproduced. So that's the same thing, if you actually... It sounds shocking to say unproduced. You know, like the Heart Sutra, which is a famous Prajnaparamita text, they go in there and they say, no eye, no ear, no nose. So maybe this is a way... I know some people are looking puzzled. This is maybe an easy way for you to see this. I challenge everyone here, especially the gentleman who's sure he won't exist. Sorry to pick on you, but it always gets me going. And especially, most interestingly, because you have one finger on your nose. So I challenge you to really find your nose, anybody here, to find your real nose. Because the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, there's no nose. It says that. So, okay. So we will immediately go, this is my nose, so I found it. But actually, what are you touching? With what are you touching it? The tip of your finger. Well, how much of your tip depends on how hard you press. Right? Then there's a piece of skin. Then you could have an accident, heaven forbid, that piece of skin would be cut off. And you still have a nose. So actually what you touch is not your nose. But arbitrarily we say for the time being, it's my nose. And we keep doing, you can keep going all over everywhere and say this is my nose. But actually everything you touch is not your nose. Because you could lose it and you still have your nose. Then the question becomes, how much would you lose and still have a nose, of course. But then, well, is there a line between your cheek here and your nose? Who drew that line? And what says this is cheek and this is nose? Is it in the nostril you have air going in and out of the passage because you breathe? Is the space in the nostril, is that the nose or is it just empty space? And then inside the nose, you know, the inner skin, etc. And then finally, you can go down to where there. If you go to a plastic surgeon, he'll have a kind of computer simulation of a nose. If you're thinking of changing your nose, like poor Michael Jackson did, he'll show all these points. But actually, we know that all the points on your nose are not there because any point, to be precise, has no size, and therefore it's not there. Right? A point has no size, so there's no point on your nose, actually. All the points on your nose are not points on your nose. They're not on your nose. And then, there's no difference between your nose and your nose. You can't find it. So we go around with the nose, and when we don't look for it, it's there. I call it the hood ornament for life. You know, like a car's hood ornament. You know, they used to have hood ornaments on cars. You know? So our hood ornament is the nose, unless we have a very small nose and we can't see it. And Americans have usually big noses, so we can see that hood ornament. So you cannot find your nose, really speaking. And then you have the benefit of particle physics, high-energy particle physics, and then they have their wave-particle paradox, and then they have their Copenhagen interpretation, and then they do have the Higgs boson named after a wonderful general. I think boson comes from Bose, not Sebastian Chandra Bose, but the other one, the physicist. And they have that famous Higgs boson. And but that's not, nobody really grabbed a hold of that. That's a bunch of inferences from a bunch of exploding particles. And then they okay, we have a mass there. But so that's the secret of mass. But actually, everything, subatomic particles, charms, spin, it all dissolves under analysis. So you can add that, because your nose has atoms, subatomic particles, and then they all dissolve under analysis. So if you took your nose and threw it into an electrocyclotron or whatever those things that are a cloud chamber, you couldn't find the nose in there, or any of the atoms in the nose. So that's non-production, no nose. But you don't find the nothing of the nose, on the other hand, either. You just can't find the nose, but you never find the absence of the nose, actually. You don't. But and then you say, well, this is silly, because I don't have to look for my nose, because there's my nose. And that's true. And that nose is a relative nose. And it's arbitrarily defined as different from the cheek and so forth. And then if you don't apply too strong a criteria of reality to it, you can live there like an illusion, like a maya. But if you try to pin it down and really find that nose, you can't find it. So that's sort of what is meant by non-production. And if you take a thought experiment like that, which I know sounds silly, and it's like arbitrary, you're saying it's just a thought experiment, but if you take that and you combine samadhi power, one-pointed concentration with that, and you really have an experience of the disappearing of your nose, then you are beginning to develop prajnaparamita, transcendent wisdom. And I think then your Vedantin yogi or yogini is beginning to develop some sort of sense of neti-neti, and they're reaching toward the area of where they might want to, they have an experience of everything kind of disappearing, which they may call, you know, tatvam azi, they may call paramatma, they may call, you know, all sorts of things, aham brahma asmi, they feel they are one with Brahma. But, and the world was just a dream, you know, like a dream. The Buddhists would never say it's just a dream. They would say like a dream, like an illusion. They never say it's maya. They say it's myopama, like a dream. And that may be a difference. That may be an important difference. That's the topic tonight, today, is a difference. That may be an important difference, actually. Calling it a dream, a complete illusion, or like an illusion is a very big difference, possibly. So both share this kind of analytic idea, and to understand what they're doing about that, I think we have to talk about what the Buddhists call, and here I don't know if Vedanta uses this kind of terminology, they call it the self-identity habit, the atmagraha, they call it, or the self-habit, or sometimes they have other expressions, but atma-svabhava graha, they have words like that, although I don't know, yeah, so I don't know if they use that language in Vedanta. Actually, I don't know that. In sort of practice manuals, I don't know if they use that, but they do in Buddhism.
This week's podcast is a selection from the Bob Thurman and Tibet House U.S. member archives. To watch the full video, please visit bobthurman.com. For more free teachings from Bob Thurman, please be sure to follow Tibet House U.S. on YouTube. Video versions of classic podcasts are posted weekly. And now back to Bob.
What these neti neti processes are doing, or the critical analysis called vipassana in Sanskrit of prajna, of wisdom, is they are actually taking the bit in their own experiential teeth, and they are looking for the reality of objects and subjects and subjectivities and the mind as well, looking for it with full force and with a very high concentration, with a mental stability that is like some kind of atom-splitting machine. actually just as powerful, because the mind is capable of that, according to Indian scientists, actually, Adhyatma Vidya, Indian inner scientists. The mind is a very powerful instrument. You don't just have to have some sort of a gun-like machine shooting molecules around. The mind is, because actually the mind is made, the body is made of molecules that are shooting around. And they can become self-aware, is the claim in all of the Indian traditions, not just Buddhism. And so this is the similarity, that both are transcending our illusory participation in a world as if the world was all a bunch of things in itself. And of course, the worst part of that, that both Buddhism and Vedanta is concerned with, the biggest thing in itself for everybody here is themselves. Every person thinks I'm a thing in itself. What do you mean? The one thing I know is real is me. So this is the problem, that intrinsic reality habit, or intrinsic identity habit, or intrinsic self habit, being attached to the self itself, thinking I'm the greatest thing. And of course, then Vedanta goes up to where actually the supreme self is the self that is beyond that little petty individual self. So they are also critiquing that feeling, the same way as the Buddhists. But then they call the state of freedom from that critique the supreme self, and the Buddhists call it the selflessness. That's the difference. Although then the Buddhists have language. They say, Nairatmya Paramatma, the supreme self of selflessness. They say that. And then they get into this kind of thing, achintya, you know, like Bob Goldman was mentioning earlier. Inconceivable, unthinkable. That's what reality is. And that's not rocket science either, right? Like you have a delicious apple, and then you read 10, 20 poems about an apple, and you read like 100 chemical formulas about the constitution of the apple, and geology and agriculture and whatever it is, you look every verbal description of that apple, and you see 10 still life paintings of that apple. And then you eat the apple, and then your experience of eating that delicious apple, none of those descriptions are adequate. It's somehow beyond the expression of all of those different things. Even though you say, I'm eating the apple, but what's happening is a lot more complicated than I'm eating the apple or any other formula or anything, right? It's an inconceivable experience, actually, an inexpressible experience. And I like that about Buddha. He said, I'm a Buddha, means I know everything now. However, unfortunately, I can't explain it to you because it's inexpressible. But I can give you some critical, you know, pathways of analysis and thought and meditation and practice where you can also experience everything, which is very radical. That's an Indian thing. Indian people are radical. They look very peaceful and quiet, but they're radical. And that culture was radical compared to the Western culture because they taught that the human being has the capacity of understanding the nature of reality. Paramartha Satya. Human being can do that. You don't hear that in the West. Scientists, oh yeah, we're realistic. We analyze this gene, we analyze this cell, this molecule, this astro, you know, the collision of black holes and blah, blah, blah. We're still looking for dark matter. It's really dark, so we can't see it. And we haven't seen it yet, but we're sure it's there and we're looking for it. And they're doing that, but then they tell you, well, every time you find something and you know this thing, you know there's so many more things you don't know. So the idea that to know everything, if you came out of your lab at Berkeley, if you're in the science department and you say, well, I know everything, they would say, oh, that's nice. We have an institution down the street where you can go and have some Prozac and take a break because you're nuts. And then religious people, they tell you you can't know, God knows, and you don't know. So the Indian people, on the other hand, you can be God. You can know. Even Indra, you know, the gods, when somebody becomes a big ascetic and they do tapas and they get all heat and they get deep insights, then the gods get mad because they think they're coming to take away their throne in heaven. So they challenge them. Because even the gods admit that the humans can come to know something in India. And, you know, Tattvamasi, you know, the high statement in Vedanta, from Brahma Sutra, you know, you are that, meaning you are God. Aham Brahmohasimi, I am Brahma, thought of as a supreme being, you know. That in the West, that's the pantheistic heresy. You know, the idea that God is in you. And you get executed for that in the Western history. You get burned at the stake. You know, you can be a mystic and get away with it if you don't say it too loud. But mostly you get executed for that. That's a heresy, in other words. Whereas in India, everybody tries to be God, you know. Anybody who gets educated, any Brahmins, they try. And they succeed, actually. So many of them have kind of succeeded. And many have become Buddhas and enlightened. Many. And now we're sort of fooling around with that in the West. But unfortunately, most of the people here think enlightenment means the great experience of not knowing anything. Somebody was saying in the conference, I was down there, the non-duality conference in San Jose, some lady came up and said, oh, I'm so happy. Well, why? Well, I've been hearing how that the highest achievement is the experience of not knowing. So what I want to know, I asked her, I said, well, you mean when Buddha attained enlightenment, what he said was, duh. Is that what you say? You know, although there is a language, again, they say, you know nirvana by the path of not knowing. But what they mean by that is that you give up trying to know it dualistically, where you want to make it fit with your concept that you had ahead of time. Why do we bored in life? Why do we have very little fun in life? Because any experience that we experience, we fit it right away into a concept that we already preconceived. So we feel comfortable that we recognized it and it's sort of under control and it fits with our network of expected experiences. And if something doesn't fit in our concept, we feel uneasy and we feel a little bit lost. And therefore, nothing ever surprises us. And we have a very hard time letting go and seeing a new dimension in whatever it is. Although we admire poetry because poets see the same things we do and then they find other dimensions in them. Like Shelley, the famous poet Shelley said, poets are unacknowledged legislators of mankind, by which he meant that they see new perspectives in things that add to our stock of concepts to enable us to have deeper experiences and more beautiful experiences of things, or more horrific experience, depending on where they're trying to open up our awareness. So now coming back to the differences of Buddhism, of non-dualism, Buddhism and Vedanta. So therefore, non-dualism is very challenging also. Because non-dualism ultimately means that the ultimate reality and relative reality are a duality that is transcended by non-dualism. So that means that relative reality is ultimate in its relativity. And ultimately, again, this is inexpressible, but they're very good at giving vectors of enabling us to have a kind of sense of what it is beyond which we cannot conceive and cannot understand, and therefore it's achintya, or inconceivable. And the great philosophers in Sanskrit, both Hindu and Buddhist and Jain, and any other group that might have arisen, they are the greatest philosophers of the world. I'm very sorry, Mr. Greek, Mr. Socrates, Mr. Persia, Mr. China. The Indians were the best. Sanskrit is a special language for philosophy, for science. It's made, Sanskrit means perfected, made perfectly accurate. Of course, nothing is absolutely perfect, but the closest to that is Devabhasha, the language of the gods. Am I right, Dr. Goldman? Yes, sir. Yes. And actually, in America, I don't people know that, in the 1890s, many colleges in the Ivy League taught Sanskrit in classics departments. And it's a disgrace that they have ceased to do that. And we have to fight and make South Asia department or do something to get a Sanskrit chair or lectureship or anything on any campus, supposedly a great church university, because they're all out there trying to make money by getting patents, by making some drugs or some bombs or something. And that's what they think is important in our universities. And they don't think that knowledge... In fact, you know, the only way you can be a well-known philosopher in America nowadays is find out a new way of pronouncing philosophy as dead. You have to say philosophy died. And it no longer helps. So we just do literary criticism or art criticism or ethical or political criticism, like someone like Richard Rorty, you know, the mirror of nature, philosophy is finished. Because a human being can't understand anything. You just have the machines and your natural sciences are going to measure everything. That's how pathetic we've become, actually. I'm sorry, we think we're super modern and super civilized. And look at us. Look at what we elected. Look at what we're doing to the planet. It's really sad, you know. Really. We're a bunch of nihilists. So, anyway. But here's where there might be a tiny difference. You know, that that supreme... There's really no difference. It's not the difference of anatma and paramatma, supreme self and no self. That's not really a difference. Because the no self is know all these kind of minor selves. And then selflessness is where the self expands to embrace everything. And that they call supreme self. And that's okay. And Buddhists sometimes do that too. Basically, like as I said, they make expressions like supreme self of selflessness. So that's not the big difference. But there might be this one difference. There's two kinds of oneness. Here, Swamiji, maybe I mentioned this the other day, but I want to mention it again. And I'm very intent about this one. You know, shunyata karuna garbham. So shunyata, emptiness, the womb of wisdom. You know, one of the deepest ways of expressing non-duality. I'm sorry, in emptiness, the womb of compassion. Terrible. So in a way, that's a wisdom and compassion indivisible. It's a similar type of expression. And why compassion, people say? Well, if you realize emptiness, then you realize sort of everything, you go beyond everything. And there is an experience of anybody who does this kind of, anybody who reads this chapter in the Wisdom or the 27 critiques of different notions of solid reality that Nagarjuna has there, which are kind of like an atom-smashing text. These 27 critiques. If you read these critiques, pretty much everything disappears. And you do have an experience as if the world disappears and you, looking at it, disappear with it. And you don't disappear just like falling asleep and disappearing. You disappear in a kind of luminous space where there's a feeling of infinite energy. There is definitely this experience that, that great yogis and mystics and philosophers and scientists, and all Indian scientists are yogis. Yogi, yogini, they're all yogis. Yogi just means you yoke your own personal experience, your mind, your heart, your perceptual mechanisms. You yoke that to your quest for ultimate union, ultimate reality. You know, you don't, it's not just something you play around outside and it doesn't affect you personally, because you're just doing some conceptual manipulations over here or with some machinery. Yogi means you yoke your life to what you do. And I think actually many scientists, material scientists, who are deeply non-dogmatically sitting there hanging on to their dogma of materialism, but who are deeply looking into nature with great effort and with painstaking care and working very, very hard, they are yogis. They put their whole life into it. There was a famous physicist yogi, which may just be a joke, but there's a story told around Columbia having to do with the Manhattan Project, where they made the atom bomb, you know, started making the atom bomb before they moved it out into the desert and started in Manhattan, in Columbia. And that one physics professor, when he came to his lab, he had a pair of snowshoes hanging on the wall in his lab. And he would put them on, and he would clump around the lab with his snowshoes. And then this graduate student finally worked up their courage, and he said, "Professor, why do you come to the lab and go clumping around in your snowshoes?" And he said, "Well, because when I come here, my mind gets into thinking of things in terms of their atomic and subatomic nature. And I'm increasing my chances of not falling down through the floor into the subway." I like that one. I'm sorry. I like my own jokes. What can I say? So there is this experience, and it's a very powerful one. And what's great about it is that because you remain conscious going into this experience, you go past kind of a tendency to wish to go unconscious, like a deep sleep state. And this is like turiya. They call it turiya. It's a fourth state. It's neither the waking or normal waking state of the subject-object difference, where you're an isolated subjectivity within a world of objects. It's not the dream state. And it's not the deep sleep unconscious state. It's a fourth state. So there is a state like that. And then there is a danger of thinking that that state is the absolute state. And there, one is absolute there. And so then people come back from that state in various places and societies, because it's not just in India that this is achieved. Other people have achieved it through other traditions. And they say, wow, I was in the absolute. All reality was one. I wasn't just selfishly there, because in a way I wasn't there, but yet I was there. My awareness was that whole state. And therefore, but now I'm back. I'm not sure why, but by momentum, I guess. But I'll go back there when I pass away, and that'll be my nirvana. And that must have been what happened to Buddha when he attained prior nirvana. That's what it must mean. So, in other words, the ultimate state is some place apart from the relative state. But how can that be non-duality? That can't be non-duality unless somehow that ultimate destroys the relative. And that's not nice. But there's a real temptation, because that state is just as real to the yogi as when I clap my hand on the pillar and it feels really hard on my hand, you know, and that's therefore reality, you know. Like G.E. Moore, one philosopher who used to debate with Wittgenstein in England, he used to pound his hand on the table and he'd say, this is real, you know, and he'd whack his hand on the table. He didn't like this sort of critical thing about how it was a construct in a way. It was not necessarily ultimately real. So then that vast absence of everything is a kind of blissful, and it's a kind of release, because there's nothing else that can bother you, so you're not frightened of the rest of the world, because you feel the whole world is this, in that. So it's a great oneness, but nobody's home in the oneness, including yourself. And you then can call that. There's a danger of calling that Brahma, God, you know, Supreme Self, whatever. You can call all kinds of things and act like you're enlightened when you're back in town afterwards, or in the ashram, or in the monastery, or in the Buddhist monastery, whatever. Buddhists, this happens to them too. And the Christians too, other mystics, Kabbalists, Sufis. But non-duality, karana part, shunyata karana. Karana part means there has to be a moving together of that experience, because if that experience is apart from this experience of all relative maya, illusory type of things, then it's a relative state, not the absolute state, because there's a boundary between it and this state. Even though when you're in it, it seems like it has swallowed this state. But still, that happened at a temporal moment, and then you come back out of it, and that's a temporal moment. That makes it a relative state. It has a boundary, time and space. The real one is where it's that ocean of bliss, and that's where the inconceivability comes in, that ocean of bliss, that Satchit Ananda, and also everybody hanging around town. It's the same thing, exact same thing. So this is all ocean of bliss, but we're all here. It's all one, and everybody's there. Okay? And then why do you need karuna? Well, gee whiz, not so many people see the ocean of bliss side of it. Do they now? Even their societies more or less don't allow them to. It's like considered a little dangerous or something. Maybe they won't know what to do. They won't be able to fight. They won't be able to drive on the right side of the road. They won't be responsible for themselves. They'll be like, it's all an ocean of bliss. But that's shunyata karuna garbham. And I believe that in Vedanta, when you are one with Brahma, and after all, Brahma is creator for them, they're seen, you know, among others, but Brahma, sometimes they call it something else, but there is the idea of that creator, and then the world is Brahma's dream, I think. And the illusion you wake up from is like a dream of Brahma. But the dream is not completely unreal. A dream is similar to unreal, but, you know, it has some quality of reality about it. And particularly because in that dream there are many beings who are suffering, who don't know they're in some ocean of bliss, Satchit Ananda. And in fact they're feeling, oh, where's my Ananda? Where's my Chit? And I don't even know if I'm Sat. And a lot of them are so scared of that that they go and have a theory that they're going to basically be nothing. And that just feels like a safe zone to them, actually. And they even fool themselves thinking they're so brave to think there'll be nothing, which is a complete self-deception, because when you're in pain, you welcome being nothing. You shoot up. You demand an anesthesia when you're having an open heart surgery or something. You don't want to feel that. And you like to be unconscious for certain things. And even we have a saying in English, ignorance is bliss. Meaning there's many things we don't want to know. The opposite, Vedanta and Buddhism say ignorance is suffering, is the cause of suffering, and wisdom is bliss, knowledge is bliss. Am I right? Swamiji agrees with that. But this is a tricky one, because people, are the compassion part seems hard. If you see, but theoretically speaking, Buddha sees beings. He takes that to be a Buddha by definition. I don't even know if there is such a thing, by the way. I'm not one, and I'm not sure I've met one. I might have. I met some people I thought were pretty spectacular, but I don't know if they were Buddhas, because it takes one to know one, and I'm not one. So I don't even know. It could be just a fantasy. But how it's defined is very technical, and it's defined as a being that finds oneness without departing from being connected to everything, in the kind of absolute relativity of the world. And in this absolute relativity of the world, meaning in a way that the absolute is empty as anything, any kind of absolute that would be apart from the world is empty, and emptiness is empty, and therefore the absolute is the world, right? And therefore, and they're only capable of seeing that because of the Ananda vision. And they see all the beings as made of Ananda. You know, if Buddha was there and he looked at us or looked at me, he would see me who has a headache, I'm going to catch an airplane, my voice is hoarse, I'm like a harried professor, I'm 76 years old, I'm trying to retire. But he would see me as made of bliss. Like every cell in my body is pure Ananda. And chit and sat. Buddha would see that, like that. They call it bliss void indivisible, they call it. But then he couldn't not see that I don't think so. What is this bliss? I have a sore back, my toe hurts. What's the bliss? So then, because of complete empathy, complete perception of everything from every direction by definition, human beings can expand their identification. Buddha is defined as one has infinitely expanded that sense of self-identification. That's supreme self, where you're everybody. Okay? So your compassion then knows that the beings don't feel that way. And yet they can't just be sort of brainwashed that they have to. They can't bomb them into bliss. If they released a huge energy of bliss, then beings would feel frightened and would get more contracted and more closed off. And they'd feel they were being assaulted by something. So compassion can only figure out art form, educational forms, teaching forms, sutras, shastras, where the beings will open their mind through gaining deeper knowledge, through discovering what is in front of them, through discovering what they are. So then the poor Buddha has to be a teacher, shastra.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit tenzingchogyal.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. For a complete listing of all upcoming events, please visit bobthurman.com. To learn about special intensive retreats and programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Please be sure to like and subscribe on iTunes and your favorite podcasting platform.